Tanta Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Ecology of Everyday Things by Mark Everard, narrated by David Vickery. Reasonable efforts have been made to publish reliable data and information, but the author and publisher cannot assume responsibility for the validity of all materials or the consequences of their use. The authors and publishers have attempted to trace the copyright holders of all materials reproduced in this publication, and apologize to copyright holders if permission to publish in this form has not been obtained. If any copyright material has not been acknowledged, please write and let us know so we may rectify in any future reprint. Except as permitted under US copyright law, no part of this book may be reprinted, reproduced, transmitted, or utilized in any form by any electronic, mechanical, or other means now known or hereafter invented, including photocopying, microfilming, and recording, or in any information storage or retrieval system without written permission from the publishers. 1. The nature of modern society. We live in an era of unprecedented technological miracles. If we could pluck someone from medieval times and drop them into our homes today, I'm sure we would blow their minds, and not merely about the achievement of time travel. This temporally displaced person would wonder that water is piped into our homes, available hot or cold at any time of day or night, and in any season, and that our wastewater is magically spirited away when we're done with it. They would be stunned that there was little or no seasonality to the food we buy and consume, with exotic and staple foodstuffs, including non-indigenous products that have today become staples, available not only year-round but also 24/7, and even delivered to our doors on demand. Also, of course, that we could demand things of that nature through the apparent power of telepathy granted us by telephones and computers. That power comes conveniently and dependably through plug sockets in every room for our utility, to light rooms at nightfall, play music at the push of a button, and run televisions, computers, dishwashers, and vacuum cleaners, would appear to be sorcery. Imagine how this person would react when feeling unwell, not having to run to the river to find leeches to let blood to oust the disease, but instead offered a choice of remedies from a veritable pharmacopoeia of pills and potions, kept handy to tackle a variety of ailments. And how would our fictional time traveller react to the astounding comfort of our homes, well insulated against drafts and storms, rain and snow, frost and heat waves, warmed or cooled at the twist of a dial? They would wonder at the fact that few of us go hungry, selecting from a smorgasbord of specialty foods from five continents, where they were formerly reserved only as festival dishes. They might be surprised that we don't smell, or at least that we can choose to wash or not, as and when we like, night or day, not by trekking down to an icy river, but from water plumbed right into our homes and warmed for our comfort. Perhaps we too should marvel more often at how our near-miraculous, yet now commonplace-built infrastructure has given us access to nature's richness within our own homes. All these technologically-enabled domestic conveniences exist for the simple purposes of plugging us into a deeper and more fundamental natural infrastructure, the cycles and flows of nature's resources, upon which we depend utterly, yet may give little or no thought. The ease with which we now access these ultimately natural products and flows tends to dull awareness of our continuing dependency upon nature in meeting our daily needs. Like all of nature, we interact with all of nature in the ways we eat, breathe, drink, and excrete, and in the other myriad ways in which we meet our needs and demands. We have great ingenuity in manipulating the natural world to meet our demands, from agricultural and industrial production to river engineering, forestry, construction, energy harvesting, and in so many other ways. To some extent, we're not alone in this, as many other creatures manipulate natural systems to promote their own ends. For example, beavers in Europe and North America dam rivers and divert flows for protection and to increase feeding opportunities. African elephants push down trees to maintain an open grazing sward in savanna and forest fringes. Ants herd and protect aphids to benefit from their secretions of honeydew, tamped from the sugars in the veins of plants. and parasites of all types exploit other organisms as sources of nutrition, protection, transport, and transmission. Indeed, it is the collective action of all living things that maintains the atmosphere, which recycles gases and distributes spores and chemical signals, and which shields us from damaging radiation from space, thereby making the continuation of life possible on this small blue sphere, cartwheeling through the dark void of space. Like all of nature, we are indivisibly connected, down to the finest organelles and biochemicals in each of the cells of our bodies, with all of the nature with which we co-evolved. We too manipulate natural systems to promote our own advantage. However, the sheer range and scale of humanity's capacity to manipulate ecosystems for our own ends has no parallels elsewhere in nature. We have replumbed water flows across entire subcontinents to serve burgeoning cities and thirsty farming and industrial activities. We have appropriated the productive capacities of some 24% of the land surface of this planet for our own exclusive use, sweeping away the complex habitats and ecosystems that have evolved there over millions of years, along with the diversity of benefits they confer in terms of stabilizing the climate, recycling and regenerating energy and matter, buffering and purifying water, supporting wildlife of inherent and also recreational and aesthetic value, amongst a host of other natural processes. We have tamed and selectively bred some animals for food, muscle power, decoration, protection, or companionship. At the same time, mushrooming human numbers and our associated demands for resources have driven other creatures that may be potential predators, pests, or competitors to scarcity or extinction. We have also been merciless with organisms that could be a source or vector of human, stock, or crop diseases, using control methods often with a far wider footprint of ecological damage. We have, in short, profoundly changed the face of the Earth, its waters, the stability of its climate system, and the balance and nature of its ecosystems. However, this book is not about environmental crisis or its solutions. See various of my other books for those studies of environmentalist existentialism. Instead, it is about celebration. You see, those everyday technological miracles, so familiar to us, yet which would spin the head of someone from another era of history, in no way dissociate us from our fundamentally biological roots. All of those familiar technologies are, in one way or another, merely ingenious ways to channel the benefits of cooling river flows, natural energy, and nature's nutritious and remedial qualities to support and ease our emancipated modern lifestyles. But nature is still always there, supplying the goods and taking out the trash as far as its capacities allow, however remotely connected to it we are by sophisticated chains of technology, which themselves are made from and powered by nature's materials and flows. Apart from our biological nature, it is also in the nature of humanity to innovate and learn. This is nowhere more manifest than in the technological wonders of modern life, from the everyday bar of soap to the loaf of bread that we take so much for granted, as indeed in the life support systems of the International Space Station. Sadly, and with major consequences, it has also become part of the nature of modern society to forget our inherent and indivisible rootedness in the natural world, and that our technical prowess in accessing it has to be considered and reformed with far more informed far-sightedness about its wider impacts. Sometimes we take ourselves off to extraordinary places to experience the rawness, the awesomeness of nature. Whether as a physical experience, or vicariously via television, other media, or in a flight of the mind, we might experience the surging flows of a powerful river, feel the vigor of a fresh-run salmon on our fishing line, stride on a mountain ridge fighting for a footing against a buffeting wind, scuba dive amongst corals draped in near-psychedelic marine creatures, or watch, dumbstruck, at the spectacle of migrating waders spiraling over a desolate salt marsh. Nature in the wild is undoubtedly exhilarating and life-affirming, touching us deeply and so connecting us with parts of ourselves that are both of kind with it, but also for too long buried by a raft of daily pressures. It is inspiring to connect with life and thus to feel once again alive. But this book is a celebration of the ecology, not of the remote and the exotic, but of everyday things. It opens a window to look at everything from a simple cup of tea, a bath of water, a bowl of rice, a newspaper, a wasp, and a pile of dirt with a little less familiarity, and to see how nature is as present in the mundane and the everyday, even in space travel, as it is so evidently in a safari to the plains of Africa. It is perhaps a symptom of disconnection from the natural world consequent from daily exigencies that we miss these close yet over-familiar connections with nature in the day-to-day. From the paper upon which this book is printed to the ink imprint of its letters, the energy and water entailed in the production of both, or the powering of the e-reader device, in the wool in my pullover, and in the regeneration by remote but incessantly busy plankton and forests of the air we breathe. Nature is always underwriting our well-being insofar as its currently damaged capacities allow. As the title of this book suggests, the ecology of everyday things is all about seeing nature in the world around us. And who knows, by seeing the world differently and touching our rootedness in nature, we may enrich and inform our own lives, our ensuing decisions, and thereby also contribute to the safeguarding of prospects for the myriad people with whom we are unbreakably interconnected by our common ecological dependencies. 2. Reading the tea leaves. Thinking about all this stuff can make you thirsty. For me, that usually calls for making a cup of tea and kicking back a moment to reflect. Pausing a moment, one can see, hear, smell, and otherwise sense nature all around us. We hear it in the song of birds and the rustle of wind amongst leaves and twigs. Even from the tallest of tower blocks, we see cloudscapes, the flight of birds, raindrops on the windows and the canopies of trees far below. But the air we are breathing is also nature, as are the various processes that cleanse and regenerate it. We eat nature, no matter how processed the end results that end up on our plates. It is nature that then purifies and recycles the wastes from our bodies, even where we apply sewage treatment technologies to decontaminate the most concentrated pollutants using engineering to increase the pace of the physical, chemical, and biological processes of the natural world. It is nature also that closes the loop by regenerating our spent resources into new food and other biological productivity. And it is nature's processes that moderate the climate, recycle nutrients and water, and that regenerate the soils that produce 90% of our food. And of course, nature pervades the cup of tea around which I am warming my hands. The nature of tea. There are many forms of tea. My favorite tipple is rooibos tea, made from the dried leaves of a dryland fynbos plant known as redbush, Aspalathus linearis, from South Africa. But for the current purpose, let's just think about everyday black builder's tea. Now this tea is very much a product of the earth. The tea that we put in our teapots or in tea bags is derived from the tea plant Camellia sinensis, which occurs naturally in China, where it has been cultivated for human use for centuries. The black tea familiar in the West is a cured and crumbled form of the tea plant's leaves, its darkness resulting from the breakdown of chlorophyll to produce tannins. In its uncured form, green tea has long been ascribed a variety of properties beneficial to human health. Indeed, the health effects of infusions from the tea plant have been exploited and explored since around 4,700 years ago, when China's legendary emperor Shennong claimed in the Divine Farmer's Herb Root classic that they were useful in the treatment of a range of medical conditions that included abscesses, bladder ailments, lethargy, and tumours. The biological activity of the tea plant, or indeed any plant, should not be a surprise. You see, one of the interesting challenges faced by plants, rooted plants in particular, arises from the fact that they cannot run away from things that want to eat or infect them, nor uproot themselves to cozy up to others of their kind. As part of their remarkable survival strategies, modern plants have been imbued by evolution with an impressive array of chemical defense, communication, and hormonal systems. Remarkably, plants also synthesize this fantastic complexity and diversity of chemicals at background temperatures, in water, and generating no residual waste, forging them from no more than water, air, sunlight, and nutrients from the soil. We have serious lessons to learn from the everyday alchemy of plants when we contrast that with our own high-temperature, high-energy chemical manufacturing processes, often in exotic solvents, with all sorts of potentially polluting byproducts. Some of these plant-generated, biologically active chemicals manifest as poisons, odors that may be pleasant or repulsive, or as substances with herbal or medicinal benefits. Humanity has made wide use of many of these beneficial properties. Various traditional medicine practices based on the properties of herbs rely directly on the genetic intelligence encoded by plants as a product of 3.85 billion years of evolution. So too does a large proportion of modern drugs, including also the substantial number of manufactured drugs that replicate or are modified forms of the structures and properties of naturally produced molecules. And of course, we co-evolved as part of this network of ecological interactions. Scientific research has confirmed some of the beneficial properties of green tea for humans, many of them related to its powerful antioxidant properties. For the detail lovers amongst us, like me, one of the most significant antioxidant constituents are the catechins, which can comprise up to 30% of the dry weight of freshly picked tea leaves. The range of observed health benefits includes reducing blood pressure and risks of cardiovascular disease, as well as some types of cancer, assisting with management of weight, antibacterial and antiviral properties, and some protection from ultraviolet radiation, in addition to neuroprotective qualities. Substances in tea, known as catechins, also react with the same cellular mechanisms that are receptive to cannabinoids, a group of chemicals including the active ingredients of the cannabis plant, and which affect cellular mechanisms in ways that suppress pain and nausea, explaining at least some of the overall calming effects of tea. These qualities, in addition to the slightly bitter taste and astringent properties released when infused in boiling water, meant that tea was initially regarded as a medicinal drink in China. However, the wider global enjoyment of tea as a beverage came first to Europe, with Portuguese priests and merchants returning from China during the 16th century, with tea consumption becoming increasingly popular in Britain during the 17th century. It is the British who had a major role in spreading the plant itself beyond China, appropriating the tea plant and introducing it to India in order to break China's trading monopoly. The culture and politics of tea. Today, the humble tea plant has been transplanted to soils across the world, mainly in the tropics and subtropics, but even locally, and with limited success in some temperate ones, including southern England and Wales. In 2010, world tea production reached over 4.52 million tons, with the largest tea-producing nations including China, India, Kenya, Sri Lanka, and Turkey. The tea trade is therefore massive, supporting an industry worth £629 million in the UK alone. Many strains of tea bushes are grown across this range, and the leaves are processed in a variety of different ways, including, in particular, various levels of curing controlled by heat. Today, tea is the second most consumed beverage on Earth after water, and it is also globally the most popular manufactured drink in terms of the quantities consumed, outstripping all other manufactured drinks in the world combined. Aside from its cultural importance in trade, various ceremonies are associated with tea drinking across a range of cultures. These range from the famous ritualized tea ceremonies of Japan and China, through to its role in polite society tea parties and working-class tea breaks in the Western world. By contrast, in the United States and Canada, 80% of tea is consumed as iced tea. Furthermore, tea has enjoyed moments of political significance throughout history. These range from widespread tea smuggling during the 18th century, giving Britain's masses access to a beverage formerly reserved for the wealthy, to the Boston Tea Party, which subsequently escalated into the American Revolution, when demonstrators, masquerading as Native American Indians, destroyed an entire shipment of tea in defiance of the Tea Act of 1773, which controlled its trade. More recent political protests in the United States since 2010 are also known as the Tea Party movement, referring back to the Boston Tea Party in their promotion of an agenda of cutting both taxes and public spending. Tea, thus, has an amazing nexus of geographical, economic, ceremonial, and political connotations. However, my tea today is made with boiling water and with no ritual beyond the dunking of a tea bag into the mug. In hot water, the third of a pint or so of hot water, in which the tea is infused, has also been on an extraordinary journey to reach its temporary residence in my cup. Perhaps this is a journey and a substance that we should treat with a little more respect each time we turn on the tap to fill the kettle, as a substantial proportion of the water on the planet today is made up from the materials from which the Earth was formed, coalescing into liquid form as the early Earth cooled as long as 4.4 billion years ago, shortly after the formation of the planet. Some more of this water might have originated from comets and from protoplanets formed in the outer asteroid belt, and which subsequently plunged to Earth early in its history. So that colourless, odourless fluid that we take for granted has been with us since, at least, the birth of the planet, continuously recirculated and cleansed by physical and biological processes, and residing, just for this minute or two, in my mug to dissolve the tea. That third of a pint of fresh water is also a remarkably scarce thing. Though seemingly abundant on a planet with a surface 71% covered by water, and with a blue aura produced in large measure by moisture in the atmosphere, fresh water comprises only 2.5% of the Earth's 332,500,000 cubic miles, 1,386,000,000 cubic kilometres of water resources. Furthermore, most of this fresh water is locked away as snow and ice, with substantial volumes inaccessible in deep aquifers, underground reserves. This leaves only some 0.007% of all the water on Earth accessible for direct human uses, in lakes, rivers, reservoirs, and those underground sources shallow enough to be accessed affordably. The global water resource is also far from static, recycling constantly through the atmosphere, land surfaces and vegetation and fauna, underground aquifers, surface pools, wetlands and streams, estuaries and the open sea. So, savour every drop. We will explore a little more of the magic and mystery of water later in Chapter 6, Bath Time. Of course, energy inputs are required to boil the water in order to infuse the tea. I guess I could have burned a few twigs from my garden to boil the water in my Kelly kettle, releasing solar energy captured by photosynthetic processes and locked up in the chemical structure of wood. But I didn't do this today, opting instead for the lazier path of filling the kettle from the tap, not the river, then plugging it into the mains. But the flow of power from the electricity socket is no less a product of nature. Our chosen electricity supplier has an exclusively green tariff, undertaking to build at least as much renewable energy generating capacity as its customers consume. This makes a positive contribution to Britain's increasing installed renewable energy generation capacity. However, the reality remains that what actually flows through to the kettle from the socket is a mix of energy sources in proportion to what is fed regionally into the national grid. Where we live, that mix includes a substantial proportion of power from coal-fired power stations, with some additional nuclear and wind-generated sources. In some regards, the coal-powered electricity is similar to the other option of burning twigs harvested from the garden. After all, coal is merely fossilized plant matter, formed from the remains of dense swamp forests, much of which grew 300 to 400 million years ago. These plants were rooted in a very different world from that with which we are familiar. Meganeura, giant insects related to modern-day dragonflies, but with wingspans up to 65 centimetres, over 2 feet, hawked the air, while some fish species had adapted to walk on land, giving rise to the earliest amphibians and reptiles, ultimately leading on to the rise of dinosaurs, birds and mammals. Sometimes coal is referred to as buried sunshine, as the bonds of the chemical substances from which it is composed result from the capture of solar radiation in these ancient and alien forests. Dying vegetation, sinking into and becoming buried in swampy areas. More later, in Chapter Fossilized Sunbeams. The immense weight and pressure resulting over many years from burial of peat by newer rock strata as the Earth aged progressively served to squeeze out water, compressing it to as much as 1/10 of its thickness, and rising temperatures also triggered a range of chemical transformations. It is this density of organic matter that means that coal is also energy dense, producing a substantial energy output per unit weight when burned, compared to the fresh twig from my garden. And it is for this reason that coal is used by people for so many things, from the fire in the living room hearth to it being the largest global source of energy exploited today for electricity generation. The burning of coal unleashes all those fossilized sunbeams for which we have so many uses. However, energy is just one element of what is stored and then subsequently released when coal is burned today. Coal burning also unlocks vast reserves of carbon captured from carbon dioxide gas in the early Earth atmosphere, fused with water by those ancient plants to build complex chemicals by using solar energy to fuse atmospheric carbon dioxide with water. It is this return to the atmosphere of large amounts of carbon formerly locked away in the Earth's crust that is today contributing to the phenomenon of global warming. In effect, returning the atmosphere towards an earlier phase of planetary climate and evolution, and hence giving rise to major concerns for the future. Other problems arising from the contemporary scale of coal burning relate to the release of a range of fine particulates and other potentially problematic substances into the atmosphere. In the United States alone, waste gases from coal-fired power plants are believed to cause nearly 24,000 premature deaths annually, with annual health costs in Europe stemming from the use of coal to generate electricity assessed in 2013 as running at 42.8 billion euro, 46.7 billion US dollars at current rate of conversion. However, our purpose in this chapter is not to lecture on the environmental issues associated with current energy generation and the consequent need for cleaner sources of energy, including reducing the amount of energy that we consume. Rather, it is to discover just how remarkable a fact it is that the warmth I feel from the cup of tea between my palms was captured from sunlight by ancient forests of giant horsetails, club mosses, scale trees and ferns, stalked by giant amphibians as long as 6 meters, 18 feet, as well as the 9-centimeter long, 3.5-inch forebears of modern cockroaches. The principal differences between obtaining energy by burning twigs from the garden and using electricity generated through coal burning are ones of scale, both of vast differences in time span and in terms of the sheer volume of biomass involved. So yes, the fossil energy now converted to heat in my mug of tea is as much a product of nature as the greenery I can see right now out of the window, differing only in that it was captured from the rays of a sun shining on and becoming locked away into chemical bonds in organic matter by ancestral vegetation in the Carboniferous era of Earth's long history. Today's vegetation will, in like manner, store some of the carbon liberated once again through the burning of coal, locking it away into fresh biomass, using energy captured from the sun's rays. However, a lot more of the carbon dioxide released will continue to accumulate in the atmosphere, contributing to an increasing greenhouse effect. As a visible and positive contributor to the generation of energy with less associated environmental problems, wind turbines also harvest natural flows of energy carried by air currents to feed into the grid and thence into the heating of water in my kettle. However, rather than tapping into sunlight falling to earth in primordial swamp forests, they convert energy in the here and now from the mass flow of gases in the atmosphere. This movement and its associated energy also ultimately derive from the sun, resulting from differential degrees of heating between the poles and the equator, modified by the rotation of the earth. Also, of course, the metals from which wind turbines and associated cables and other engineered structures are made are also mined from the Earth's crust, where they have been deposited by natural sedimentation, biological and other processes over geological timescales. So not only are these metals part of the natural world, but nature has played a major hand in concentrating the ores. So the turbines and gears, transformers and cables, including the wires that lead into my house and the metallic part of the kettle itself, are all a product of nature, though manipulated by human ingenuity into a form that serves our convenience. We could go on to consider the lubricants, coolants, plastics, and other substances used in the term.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?